Steel and twister space. And with this Lagrangian. So unlike the things we've discussed previously, this describes an interacting theory on twister space. So when I translate it to spacetime, it's going to be some interacting quantity too. So the question is, what are the solutions to the equations of motion? Like, what do they correspond to in spacetime? And the answer is so the equations of motion for this Lagrangian describe, firstly, a gauge field A which satisfies the following equation. The anti-self-dual part of its field strength vanishes. So this means F of A is equal to its hot star. And it also consists of the field B is going to be an anti-self-dual 2 form on spacetime, which is a covariant constant. So we're going to focus on this equation. It's called the self-duality equation. So this self-duality equation is much loved by mathematicians. It was used. It was famously used by Donaldson in his work on four manifolds, for instance. And in physics, when people study Yang-Mills instantons, so these are topologically non-trivial field configurations, normally they're studying solutions of this equation. So the equation F minus A equals 0, this implies the Yang-Mills equation. Which is dA star F A equals 0. The reason is because if F minus A is equal to 0, then star F A is equal to F A. It's self-dual. So remember, F minus we're projecting onto the components, which satisfies star F minus is minus F minus, and F plus satisfies this equation. So if F minus equal to 0, then star F is equal to F, and Bianchi identity says dA FA equals 0. So in particular, so this implies the Yang-Mills equation So yeah, this is really nice. So we've learned that this equation, which is stronger than the Young-Wills equation, can be realized in this very geometric way on twister space, or in some very natural way on twister space. Okay, any questions about this? So we can ask, what about if we work off shell? So we can know, what does this theory in twister space become in terms of Lagrangians in spacetime? Well, whatever it is, it can't be exactly Young-Mills theory, because the equation we found for A was stronger than the Young-Mills equation. However, it must be something related. And the answer is a very interesting theory. It's a 4D theory called self-dual Young-Mills. So I'm going to write the Lagrangian for self-dual Young-Mills, and we'll find that honest Young-Mills is a deformation of this by adding on some term. And by analyzing what that term does in twister space, we'll be able to do some computations in gauge theory. Well, they're old computations, but this is the cleanest way of seeing why they're true. And this discussion, as I mentioned, is very close to Witten's twister string theory. So the fields of self-dual Young-Mills
What do we mean by deformation
here? Well, this there'll be a Lagrangian, and if I add a term to the Lagrangian, I'll get the full Young-Mills theory.
But without any RG flow or anything like that. It's just adding something.
Adding some term. Okay. So this theory is conformal, and it's almost but not quite free.
Mm-hmm. OK. Thank you.
So the fields consist of a gauge field. And an anti-self-dual two form. And the Lagrangian is B wedge F minus. So it's extremely simple. B is a Lagrange multiplier field enforcing the equation that F minus is zero. So the equations of motion are that F minus equals zero and D sub A of B is equal to zero. And Mason showed, and his collaborators, Skinner, showed that this self-dual Young-Mills is equal to the theory we wrote on twister space. And this equality only holds at tree level. But that's going to be enough for us anyway. So self-dual Young Mills can be deformed to full Young Mills, and here's how we do it. So if we add the term, minus 1 over 4 g Young Mills squared trace b squared to the Lagrangian, so adding this term is going to bring us back to full Young Mills. So what we're doing is very similar to something you might have seen before. We can take a second order Lagrangian and rewrite it in first order form, or introduce a Lagrange multiplier field. And then by integrating out the Lagrange multiplier field, we get back to the second order thing. That's what's happening. Anyway, if we add this to the Lagrangian, we get we perform the field redefinition. Which sends B to B plus 2 So what I want to do is do a field redefinition which gets rid of this cross term, the bf minus term, so that I'm left with an ff term. The ff term will be Young Mills Lagrangian, and then another term, which is bb, and since b doesn't interact, I can just get rid of it. So if I perform this field redefinition, that will cancel this term that I introduced here, will cancel with that cross term. And you find so then we can integrate out B, set up B can be removed as so it has no kinetic term. So only a mass term. Yeah. So this is just some completely stupid thing we just get rid of. And we're left with the Young Mills action. Is the Young Mills action maybe up to sine and up to a topological term, which doesn't really matter. Okay, yeah.
Before introducing the other term, what is the meaning of the equation of motion for B?
It's just covariant constant. All right, covariant. It's a two form, which is covariant closed. Way of saying it. Okay. So now we can wonder if can we realize this extra term? Oh yeah.
Sorry. The up to topological term is because we have f with f instead of star f or what?
Well, actually, let me explain that. So, integral f white star f is integral f plus plus f minus. No, sorry. We do it like this. Integral f minus white f minus is integral 1/4 1 minus star f half wedge f. So f minus is like I obtained by applying 1 minus star to f. So I get integral f wedge f. This is topological. Plus integral star f wedge star f. These two terms are actually the same. And then minus integral we have f wedge star f. This is the Young-Mills term. What is integral b squared, or just say b squared, on Twister space? Well, to answer this question, let's go to the free theory. We'll see. So b squared, let me write it like this. B squared is trace b alpha dot beta dot b gamma dot delta dot epsilon alpha dot gamma dot So if I write it out more carefully, the indices for b are these pair of dotted indices, spinor indices, and it's symmetric onto them. And when I say trace b squared, you know, it's really b wedge b, but this is the only SO4 invariant way of contracting them, and I use these two epsilon tensors. So we can ask b what is b alpha dot beta dot on Twister space. Yeah.
Can you explain again why B only has dot indices?
Right. So the way it works is any two form, we'll call it F, has four indices. Because alpha alpha dot is a vector and beta beta dot is a vector. And so two form is anti-symmetric under switching these pairs. You can always write it as epsilon alpha beta f minus alpha dot beta dot. And this is symmetric. This is how you decompose a two-form into self-dual and anti-self-dual pieces. And now you see the anti-self-dual pieces has these dotted indices and the epsilon tensor absorbs the other ones. I hope this is, so whatever this comes from in twister space, if you remember, it came from something in O minus 4. It comes from curly B, and which is a 0-1 form, O minus 4. So this was, the O minus 4 was just, you know, the dictionary about spin and helicity tells us it was minus 4. And that's when I wrote this twister action up here, B was in O minus 4. Now, so this guy is a local operator. So it must correspond to some operator where I integrate over a CP1 of the curly B. Now, I'm going to recall our discussion, which I'm not sure everybody has in their heads, of like, how do I build? This was an O minus 4, and I had to build a three-component expression from it on spacetime. And the answer was, I could integrate it against three different things. So the way it worked was like B1 dot 1 dot is the integral over CP1 curly B dz. Curly B z dz. So I don't want to repeat the discussion of how we figured out what were the allowed expressions, but this was like to do with the weights, this was an O minus 4. So there was some messing around with thinking about O minus 4 and the powers of Z that come in when I transfer to the other patch that allowed me to think about what powers I'm allowed to do, not to get a pole at infinity. OK, so that's good. Just to remind you, so the goal here is to figure out what do I need to do on twister space to recover Yangel's gauge theory. So on spacetime, I have to add on this B squared. On twister space, I have to do something. And the something I have to do is turn out to be interesting. But let's finish the analysis. This tells us that trace B squared at 0 must be, well, I'm going to take products of two of these. So it's going to be a double integral. Each copy of B will give an integral over one point in CP1. So because there's two of them, I have to integrate over two points in CP1. And I have a z minus z prime squared. So where does that come from? If we think about here, that was some epsilon tensors. So the 1, 1 dot term must be paired with the 2, 2 dot term. So that gives me a z squared or a z prime squared. And this term in one factor must be paired with the same term in the other factor. That gives me the zz prime term. So this thing here gives me the epsilon tensors. Okay. So what have we learned? We've learned that if we want to build full Yang-Mills theory in twister space, we have to break locality. Because I have a double integral, and this is no longer a local expression. Yeah?
But by B alpha dot beta dot being a local operator, you mean local in space-time?
Local in space-time, yeah. And twister space, it's an integral. Yes.
I don't see how, on the left-hand side, you have some indices. Curly B is a one-form in the twister space.
Yes.
And so a one-form will have components which will have both dotted and undotted indices because...
No, it's a 0-1 form. But when, in order to preserve gauge invariance, when I do these integrals, it only makes sense to pick up the dz bar component of B.
So there are space-time contractions because of which we end up only with dotted components somehow.
I know the reason we only end up with dotted components is if you remember, our Lorentz group is a product of two copies of SL2, and the SL2 which transforms the dotted indices, it rotates the CP1. So anything with the dotted indices comes from like inserting some tensors on this CP1 which transform in some representation. So that. I mean, I've chosen coordinates, z, which kind of breaks the symmetry a little bit. But these dz, z dz, z squared dz, these transform in the relevant representation. So, any other questions? Do you guys see anything funny about this expression? Is it gauge invariant? Yeah, so suppose I'm in an ordinary gauge theory in space-time, I would say. It's some operator in the adjoint representation. And I evaluate it here, and I take its product with this evaluation here, two different points. That doesn't make sense, because the gauge transformations here and here act in a different way. So really, if I had them at the same point, it was OK. But if I move them apart, you have to stretch a Wilson line between them. So this expression is also not gauge invariant for the same reason, because I have an operator at z prime, and there's different points. And I need to stretch a Wilson line between them. But it's a funny Wilson line, because I'm integrating over a complex curve rather than a real curve. So the gauge variation, B of z, will have a term which looks like this. And the gauge variation of A will have a term which looks like B bar chi plus chi A. Maybe one of those is a minus. But this gauge variation here means there's I pick up a chi z from here and a chi z prime from here, and there's no reason for those to be the same thing. we can make it gauge invariant. Just like in ordinary spacetime, we can make things gauge invariant by stretching a Wilson line between them. There's a trick to make things gauge invariant in the holomorphic context too. This is the result of Mason. So what we need to do is we add extra terms, which are like the path ordered exponential in a Wilson line. So the full expression is going to do n intervals over C1, Cn, and take a trace I take B at C1, A, Z2, A, Z3, and at some point I turn into B one more time. To go on to A at Zn. Put this over here. And then times, this is still inside the integral. Bracket here. This is a full expression, and does anybody recognize this? Can anybody do Freddy's thing on amplitudes? You know, yes.
This is the formula for.
Yeah. Yeah. So the beautiful thing is it's just forced on you by asking if you're like, how do I know what's gauge invariant? You just, these terms are just entirely determined by being gauge invariant in twister space. So it's going to take a little thought to figure out. I mean, the formula is clearly Park-Taylor. We're going to have to think a little bit, although we're almost there. You know, we know that B corresponds to negative velocity states, A corresponds to positive velocity states. It'll take a small amount of work to go from this expression and see why it's the actual scattering amplitude. And I warn you, I probably got some factorials or something not quite right in this expression, but. Yeah, there's almost certainly some factorials in this. So let's check. This is gauge invariant. So we'll start with 2 points. So the gauge variation we get and we want to see that this cancels with one of the terms in the gauge variation of the 3-point amplitude. It looks like, let me not write every symbol. Let's say the DZs are understood. The trace is understood. I'll write it like this. So one of the terms, this was accompanied by Z1 minus Z. It looks like this. So we want to see what happens when I do a gauge transformation to A. So gauge variation of A. d bar chi plus chi a. And we're going to focus on this term. So we'll get and there's a second term which is similar. I'll ignore it for now because it'll contribute something similar. Okay. So, what's the point? I look at this expression, and I want to somehow turn it into something which looks like the expression on the left-hand side there. So the way we do it is we integrate by parts. If I take my d bar operator, I can move it around to there, or maybe to there. That will give me 0, because we're working with on-shell expressions. Secretly, the reason is that these b's are going to represent on-shell states, which are scattering. So, and then there's another term where this d bar goes over and hits here. And that's the good term, because if it hits this piece, I'll get a delta function. Or it could hit this piece, and that'll be another delta function. So I'll get a sum of two delta functions. Yeah.
Isn't that the only field that depends on z as well? Like, the other ones depend on z too?
Yes. Yeah. I'm just used to thinking of the total d bar operator acting on all variables. But yes.
Okay.
Nope, but yes, you're right. So, by parts, d bar, it's 1 over z1 minus z, 1 over z minus z2. We get bz1 chi z1 bz2. This is going to be chi b plus, I guess, minus, and then this, let's see, this is going to be multiplied by z1 minus z2 to the fourth over that goes away. One minus c2 squared. So these the other term where it hits z minus z2, that'll have a different sign because z1 minus z and z minus z2 have different signs. And if we include the term I wrote as similar, And we also get plus bz1 bz2 chi z2 again times, so 1 minus z2 squared minus okay, so this term can hit there and there, and there was another term which I wrote where the chi was over here, and then can hit this one or this one from the other side. And when I'm writing things next to each other here, implicitly this is matrix multiplication. And there's a trace too, which I have highlighted. Okay, and now you see it's the commutator.
So for three-point functions, we see that under Gauss transformation, it takes the same expression as we had for two-point functions. But there are two questions. Why are we doing the Gauss transformation only of the A fields and not of the B fields? And the other question is, this gauge variation for two-point functions should also vanish because we are claiming that the final expression we had was Gauss invariant.
Right, and the final expression, I mean, the whole sum is gauge invariant. Each term is not.
Okay.
So what will happen is, so if I look at the three-point function, there are some gauge transformations which increase the total number of fields. Those are the ones which send b to bracket of b and chi, that increases the fields by one, or send a to bracket of a and chi. So with the endpoint function, the gauge transformations which increase the number of fields will be canceled by the gauge transformations in the n plus 1 point, which don't increase the number of fields. So here, the gauge transformation of the two-point function ends up with three fields, and that's going to be canceled by the terms in the three-point function, which also have three fields. The other terms in the three-point function, gauge variation, are canceled by the four-point, and so on. This whole tower.
And why are we not doing the gauge transformation of the B fields only of the A fields in the three-point function?
Well, in the three-point function, if I vary the B fields, I increase the total number of fields.
It will be canceled. Basically.
And that'll be canceled by the four-point.
Okay.
So, and can you guys see the resemblance to a Wilson line? Like, if you know the argument, like if I have a Wilson line, we're doing a path to root exponential, why is it gauge invariant? Well, there's a boundary, you know, if I look at gauge invariant here, one thing that can happen is that there's a boundary term where it hits this, there's a boundary term where it hits that, and the other thing that can happen is there's that kind of where I do a bracket. And those cancel. And that's why a Wilson line is a gauge invariant quantity. So it's very similar, except in what's happening is that instead of looking at things which are path ordered, you know, the point of the path ordered is that, you know, d of a delta function of is a delta function when they coincide. But we're replacing that by replacing this delta function that there are, so one is after the other, by 1 over z1 minus z2. That's the replacement in the holomorphic setting.
I can't read the delta. The d of a what? Delta with what?
Delta of t1 less than t2.
Okay.
Can you explain the Wilson line again? And I have a question because I thought that the Wilson loop was invariant, but if you had a line like all the times that I was trying to understand it being gauge invariant, people said that it's because of the trace and it's because periodic boundary conditions.
Yes. But you can if you have matter of some kind, then you can make it gauge invariant by putting on a matter field at the end. So for example, if I had a quark, then the gauge variation, this guy is chi psi. And if I wanted to make, say, psi x prime, gauge invariant, you do the following. You say, make psi x prime, maybe I shouldn't write this as the commutator, because it's in the fundamental, not the adjoint. Sorry, let me write this in the other way. You know, one is a vector, the other is a covector, say. So this guy acts on the left, the other one acts on the right. So anyway, this is some bilinear with my fermions at separated points is not gauge invariant, but you can make a gauge invariant in the same way. But then you add on for the same reason we just discussed. Like the boundary term here involves the gauge variation hitting this, or the gauge variation hitting this, or the gauge variation hitting itself. And the terms of the gauge variation hitting itself are canceled by the next one. And it keeps on going, this infinite sum.
And if the matter is in a different representation, you will have this term, but in a different representation?
This expression will work no matter what representation the matter is in, as long as on one end I have matter in representation and the other end I have matter in the dual representation. And when I write these expressions, I'm viewing A as a matrix acting on that representation, and like hitting it here a bunch of times and then contracting with the covector at the end. Okay. So for this one, can you guys like kind of see why it'll all cancel, or at least it looks plausible that everything will cancel? Or
that everyone in general, or just a specific term?
That this the gauge variation of this whole expression will plausibly cancel. Because every time I have an A, I get a 1 over. Or AZN or AZK will have a 1 over ZK minus ZK plus 1. And I'll pick up these delta functions. And then there's some things to play around with. So I don't think I want to go any further with this, because it's a really fun exercise. I don't know if there's any tutorials, but maybe you could do this in a tutorial.
And is there a compact formula also for that one, like the path ordered something something?
No, because you have to, I mean, I think this is as compact as you is, as it's possible to make it. what's going on is you're replacing the path ordering by these factors of 1 over z r minus ej. So you could invent a notation that says, put in 1 over z r minus ej, and then it would look better. But
we added extra terms to make the expression gauge invariant, but is it still equal to trace of p squared at c equals 0?
On spacetime? Yes. Because, I mean, that operator on spacetime is gauge invariant. And so it must come from some gauge invariant thing upstairs. And that is the only operator of that dimension and with that kind of helicity.
So we have to think B as a matter field, or that's not. Because it is in the adjoint, isn't it?
It is in the adjoint, yeah. But for this argument here, I could have done this with any expression that transformed in any representation. It didn't have to be a fermion. I could have put the field strength here. Because the field strength is just an operator transforming in the adjoint. And then this would have made a gauge invariant expression in the same way. I will stop there, and next time I will try to explain how we get from here. Like, if I take an ordinary plane wave state, how do I represent it in twister space? And that'll explain why this is really, really is the Bork-Taylor formula.